Today, Crawley, I'm sorry, United States versus Crawley, and we'll hear from Mr. Pettigrew.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Albert Pettigrew, and I represent the appellant Jackie Crawley. I wish to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I waive the privilege to speak without questions during the first 15 minutes. Mrs. Crawley addresses two issues in this argument. First, that the court erred in giving a deliberate indifference instruction. Second, that the court erred by including statewide and progressive physical medicine as relevant conduct for purposes of calculating her restitution to Medicare. And that as part of that they unreasonably required Crawley to pay $2,500 per month in restitution when it found that she did not have the ability to pay a fine. And lastly, that it was unreasonable to make Crawley pay restitution payments as a condition of her supervised release in view of the circumstances. Turning to the first issue, Crawley's defense was that she, at trial, was that she lacked guilty knowledge of any illegal activity. Consequently, the court proposed to give the jury a deliberate indifference instruction. Of course, the general rule for deliberate indifference instruction is that it should be rarely be given, according to Threadgill. Crawley objected to the instruction and then requested a balanced instruction. The court overruled the objection and denied the request. It later gave a deliberate indifference instruction that was following the pattern guidelines that the Fifth Circuit has. There is no dispute that Crawley asserted she lacked guilty knowledge at trial, and the defense would give rise to the instruction if the evidence raised the inference that Crawley met two conditions. First, that she had a subjective awareness of a high probability of illegal activity. And second, she purposely contrived to avoid learning of the illegal activity. That's Wolford. Also, there is no dispute that this issue is subject to an abuse of discretion and harmless error review, requiring the government to demonstrate that substantial evidence supported giving the instruction or that it was harmless error. So I'll address the first prong, subjective awareness. The government fails to point to the proof that Crawley had a subjective awareness of illegal conduct. The government's response brief relies on testimony of basically Crystal Davis, Jim Hull, and Crawley's assertions to agents that this was a gray area. And regarding Crystal Davis's testimony, the government points out that there was a seminar in April of 2003 while Crawley was working for Mississippi Care Partners. Crystal Davis and Crawley were working together in Mississippi Care Partners. Crystal Davis was the billing manager. Jackie Crawley was the manager responsible for overseeing the technicians. They basically did not mix in terms of dealing with each other's areas of business. But at this time, though, there was a question, so they went to this training seminar here in New Orleans. After they attended the seminar, they came to the agreement based upon the materials they read at the seminar that they were doing things not in accordance with what the material said that should be done. Crystal Davis believed it was wrong, and so it was on a Saturday. They were going to inform their supervisors about this. That next Monday.
Before you get to next Monday, what do you do with the statement, if I've got the right seminar, of the person giving the seminar that said, if you're doing it this way, you're in big trouble?
I believe that was a quote from Crystal Davis as to what she said in the meeting on that Monday.
Did I misread the record? I thought that the person who was giving the seminar, one of the people on the program, said that.
That seminar, was oriented towards physical therapy people, and that there was a physical therapy person might have been, in big trouble doing this. But as in that next Monday, when they had the meeting, there was questions that arose, such as, well, does this apply to physical medicine? Physical therapy is different from physical medicine. We work using technicians at homes, and physical therapists work there's other ways. And we physical medicine people work under the incident to the supervision of a doctor. So there was a possibility that there was a problem and that there was an error.
Sounds to me like Mr. Crawley is creating a problem. The instructor says if you don't bill on a time basis, you're going to be in real bad trouble.
And the instructor, even though the instructor said that, they had an orientation of being in physical therapy, and maybe they weren't as all familiar with physical medicine as they would have been if they had worked for this company. But as far as...
She said she was a physical therapist.
Ms. Crawley?
Didn't she?
There was witnesses that said that she told them she was a physical therapist.
What I mean.
But in fact, she was an occupational therapy assistant.
She dissembled on that.
Well, you know, there was occasions when people testified that she dissembled. But on those occasions, you had to look at the totality of the circumstances. On those occasions, she was in an informal, small talk type situation, talking to them about this or that, and about basically, you know, who are you and what do you do type stuff. It really is of no consequence in terms of misrepresentations to Medicare. There was one, though, seems to be stand out above the others. That was the occasion when she talked to Dr. Andrea Phillips. If you recall, Dr. Andrea Phillips was at an orientation while they were in Jackson, Mississippi. And it was after the orientation was over, she came up to Ms. Crawley and said, "Well, you know, I'd like to know, get reassurances in effect that the technicians are being well trained and that." So I can have confidence in that. Jackie gave her the reassurances, and then according to Dr. Phillips, said that she was physical therapist individual. Now, looking at that, that would be a misrepresentation. But then if you look at the context, you have to ask, how do you draw an inference from that to a misrepresentation to Medicare that was being conducted by Ms. Pam Hall?
Well, but this New Orleans seminar was specifically on Medicare billing. It didn't make any fine distinctions between occupational and physical or anything like that. It was on Medicare billing, wasn't it?
It was on Medicare billing.
And they were there specifically to resolve the differences between Crawley and... Davis. So they had to be pretty much focused in, narrowed in on this issue.
And I believe that they, the testimony did not get down. It was just a small statement, I believe, by Jim Hall that he had sent the two of them over to that seminar to address some question. There was no real exploration as to how strong that how precise that question was prior to their going to the seminar. I believe that on that basis you would look at it and say there was just a basic exploration as to what the seminar might do to inform them about billing. But it did cause them to have questions. And then they brought it to the attention of the supervisors. They had a meeting after that in which the questions were unresolved. But Jim Hull did tell them that this is the way we're going to do it. The evidence also was that 2 days later, Jim Hull finally came to a decision as to how it would, between him and Crystal Davis, as to how they would be doing it in view of her continued objections about the matter. Problem was, Jim, at the seminar and at this meeting, there's really no evidence that there was any kind of criminal mind or guilty mind in going to the seminar or in exploring what the seminar informed them about on that Monday. The criminal mind formed in Jim Davis's Jim Hall's mind about 2 days later when he really didn't continue to explore the matter and instead just made a decision. Now, the question is, did that information get to Jackie Crawley? Was she aware or did she have reason to know about that? There's no evidence that Jackie Crawley was ever made aware of what Jim Hull had decided on that day, or either through Jim Hull or through Crystal Davis. And so, that affects the fact that she didn't have that kind of awareness or meet the first prong of the test.
Well, Counsel, you mentioned one of the issues you want to talk about was restitution. You're sort of running out of time with my colleagues' acceptance of this redirection. I wish you would talk a little bit about the allocation of this amount of restitution to her.
In terms of the restitution that was allocated to her, there was, in the cases that I decided, I believe, Inman, the case I was talking about. Basically, any kind of restitution has to be directly flowing from the criminal activity which she's charged. It also has to be temporarily encompassed based upon the time frame in the indictment. The time frame in the indictment was from January 2004 through December 2004. However, Crawley was charged or allocated restitution to Medicare for time frames that were prior to that, such as when she worked for Statewide. Her relationship with Statewide ended in 2003. And there was nothing to indicate that Statewide was connected with Rehabilitare or that Rehabilitare was connected with Progressive Physical Medicine.
Irrespective of the periods, even if it included another period, there was something in the rough neighborhood of $14 million attributed to her, wasn't it?
Yes. She was attributed basically the entire amount for every claim that was made
by
this company.
But her personal, apart from relevant conduct, she personally was supposed to have had like $14 million.
That's right. That's because of the allocation from Statewide and
Progressive. And yet she says she has no ability to pay fines or restitution. What happened to that money?
She was a very small person in this business. She was a 5% owner of Rehabilitare according to the way the contract was, but the lion's share, I don't know what percentage I would say, but I would just estimate most substantially all the money went to Pam Hull. But according to the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act, she's responsible for 100% of the entire claim.
Was there evidence of what money went to her, how much money she got out of this business?
There was some evidence in the case about the fact that she received some monies throughout the year, basically normal paycheck and some bonuses. I think it about amounted somewhere in the nature of $100,000, but I'm not sure about those numbers.
Now, Counsel, you didn't try it, did you? You just on appeal?
I tried it.
Oh, you tried it. Well, the only point you made at sentencing about restitution was you argued that the amount ought to be minimal. You did not present any evidence or make any position, as I know, or any evidence about her ability to pay.
I started to raise or try to present some evidence on that way, but then the court stopped me and said, well, I've already said it already had decided that she didn't have the ability to pay a fine. And so I inferred from that the court, she didn't have to be able to pay the fine. She didn't have the ability to pay any kind of restitution either. So I drew that as a conclusion of the court.
Was there any thing said about once she completed her prison term and was in a position to have supervised release, that there would be some sort of reexamination of her ability to pay restitution then? Because I know he conditioned supervised release on paying like $2,500 a month.
No, sir, it was nothing like that.
Okay.
Now I'll rest.
All right. We'll hear from you on rebuttal. Okay, Mr. Cleveland.
you mind starting where we left off on restitution, and particularly on the requirement that she has to make her payments to have supervised release?
Well, let me do say, Your Honors, that there was no objection made with respect to that issue at sentencing. It is a discretionary position under the statute. The court did require the payment. There's no discussion or elaboration in the record as to why the court chose to do so. I can tell the court just from experience that the courts, as well as the probation office, they work very hard with people who are on probation and supervised release to make sure that they do get employed, that they do try to meet their obligations, and they try to be as reasonable as they can.
Well, what are we going to do about supervised release being conditioned on her paying money, particularly after the trial court has already said she can't even pay a fine?
I think we're going to have to leave it to the best judgment of the trial judge to exercise his experience, considerable experience.
The trial judge, is he going to decide whether she gets supervised release? She's completed her time and would otherwise be entitled to it?
The supervised release is a condition that will follow. She will be under supervised release, and the trial judge will have the responsibility for supervising her, making a determination whether an inability to pay a fine.
In other words, we can assume that his order is not what he said, but that it is conditioned on her ability to pay.
Well, it is what it says it is, but I think we have to look to the judge to exercise.
The government have any problem if this panel, assuming everything else is affirmed, were to modify the judgment and affirm it as modified to take care of this conundrum of
well,
conditioning it on something but for someone that has no ability right. to pay?
Our concern is in depriving the trial judge of making the call in the first instance, because there was no objection. This should be subject to plain error review. This is just a discretionary call that's entrusted by Congress with the district judge. And that's my sort of institutional concern, but no, there's no actual concern with respect to this particular case otherwise. But let me just do speak more generally to a concern on the restitution. We are hearing for the first time here and in the reply brief, for the first time on appeal, a claim that was never articulated below with respect to the restitution amount, and it's namely the need to compare the temporal scope of the charge conduct with the time frame of the conduct that's the basis for the restitution. Here's all that got said on the subject of the restitution amount below. There was a written objection to the restitution, which consisted of two sentences, only the second of which addressed the amount. Crawley objects to the amount of restitution considering her circumstances and participation in the offense. That's all that was in the written objection. And during the sentencing hearing, the judge asked counsel, is your argument with regard to relevant conduct related to the computations of intended loss? And the answer was, yes, Your Honor, it relates as well to any kind of restitution determination. That is the sum total of what got said on the restitution amount issue below. And I would submit that's not sufficient to preserve error on the temporal scope claim that Crawley is belatedly asking this court to consider. In her opening brief, Crawley argued the restitution amount should be confined to the counts of conviction, and that, of course, ignores the Mandatory Victim Witness Restitution Act, which authorizes restitution for anyone harmed by the defendant's criminal conduct in the course of the scheme. And the temporal scope claim is a new argument that raises what is a question of fact that should have been presented to the district court.
Just speaking as one member of the panel, I'm not particularly concerned with the amount of restitution because you can't get blood out of a turnip.
That's true. Right.
I am concerned with conditioning supervised release on payment of $2,500 a month or whatever it was when you've already determined you can't even pay a fine. And there's nothing in the judgment that says that when the time comes for supervised release, this will be examined. Now, maybe it's done as a matter of course, but if it's in there, I don't recall seeing it.
No, I don't believe that it is. It is something that the determination of whether somebody has violated their conditions such as would warrant an actual revocation of the supervised release is a decision that's made all the time by the district judges, and they try to make reasoned judgments as to whether revocation is necessary.
I recall seeing a number of these where you have restitution and supervised release and put in express conditions about ability to pay at the time. And I didn't see one here.
I'm taking a look at the judgment as well, which appears at page this schedule of payments is at page 322 of the record, and the court did not specify that provision that Your Honor is referring
okay.
to.
I think we.
All right. Well, Mr. Let me ask one more question. Excuse me, Tom.
In that Calvert case, Fifth Circuit sent the case back on this particular point for the trial court to take evidence and decide what whether or not there be any condition on supervised release and payment. Are you familiar with that?
Although that's a more unwieldy process of sending it back, it does respect the discretion of the district judge to make the determination.
You wouldn't have an objection to that?
No, Your Honor. This court, the district court, did not, as I was indicating, get an opportunity to make the factual finding with respect to this temporal scope issue that's only come up in the reply brief. We have sort of an interesting issue. I'm about to march into that. I just realized that Judge Southwick had a question that was going to.
Well, as long as you're still on restitution, let me ask. I'm looking at the schedule of payment page that you referred us to, and I'm not sure what is the standard form with the way forms can be produced now. Is this $2,500 per month just on the face of the document language that's in the form that wasn't decided by Judge Girola at the time? Is sort of the default obligation, or do you know offhand?
I don't know whether the amount is a default amount.
Okay, it's just a photocopy, but it's entirely the same print, font, and whatever as if it's part of the form, without any determination by Judge Girola's independent ability to pay.
I'd be hard pressed to say based on looking at the document. Because there really is not a differentiation between the typeface, between what the court is adding, and what is on the standard form. There's not a difference for me to have much confidence in that. The restitution was ordered as part of the two companion cases. There's a Mississippi Care Partners case, which is actually on appeal, and there was a plea agreement in that case, which the court has available in 09-60573. In that plea agreement, the defendant agreed she would be liable to make restitution for the full amount of the loss, not limited to the count of conviction, to the full amount of the relevant conduct. So the court never got a chance to invoke that plea agreement in setting the total amount. Let me turn briefly to the.
What does the evidence show about the relation between this restitution and that particular year of the offenses charged?
There is nothing, not much as far as what got billed to the Medicare program. We know the conduct dated all the way back to the trial is riddled with her association with these various companies back to Statewide Medical. But what the record does not allow us to see, because it was never asked to be illuminated, is is what, where did the billed amount fall? Was it all within the time frame or was it not? So that simply was never, because it was never developed, because it was never raised.
So we don't know where the judge got this figure.
We know that the judge got the figure for the companies, for the four companies with which she was associated.
And that's outside the year.
Some of it falls with outside the year.
Right.
But the issue was not raised below, so this question of fact never got developed. And on the subject of the jury instructions and the deliberate ignorance issue, Mr. Pettigrew focuses solely on this, what did she know about how to bill issue, Judge Wehner, your question with respect to the what was said at the seminar, it's page 580 of the court reporter's transcript. According to Crystal Davis, she and Crawley were present when the instructor said, if you were billing by party body part versus for 15-minute increments, you were in big trouble. But you don't even have to look only at that. We're talking about a conduct that goes well beyond just billing practices. Ms. Crawley lied about her qualifications, claiming to be a licensed therapist when, in fact, she was not. She inflated the billings by adding check marks to treatment sheets, and there's testimony that that conduct went all the way back to when she was at Statewide.
Let me ask on that.
Yes.
You emphasize it, understandably, several times. Are those check marks potentially consistent with her position that you don't charge by time increments but by different parts of the body? Do those two fit together?
She was as the office manager, was the one who got the treatment sheets that would come in from the technicians. She trained the technicians, and then she would get the treatment sheets would come in. And she was manually adding check marks in a way that the couple of the technicians who saw this and knew the process and knew that this was adding it for purposes that had nothing to do with the treatment.
And also the dates. Arranged for when the doctors or
exactly.
technicians were there.
She would instruct the technicians to add the date for a signature block for the doctors who never saw these patients during this process. It was all just a ruse to make it look like this was all pursuant to a course of medical treatment when, in fact, it was not.
Let me ask about the doctors. I did not see any clear indication, and at least in this particular group of prosecutions, that any doctors were indicted?
I'm not familiar with that having been done, and I don't know. I don't know the history of the prosecution.
One of the necessary components of this, as I understand, are Medicare numbers from physicians.
Right.
And so they're at least involved to that extent in allowing this documentation to be presented to Medicare. So it did seem odd to me that we have this little story of these physical therapists doing massages, getting millions of dollars for it, based on doctor numbers, but no doctors are being prosecuted for this.
Well, I cannot speak for why the decision was made or whether it's even been made, but I think that they went through the process of putting sort of a medical director hat on some of these doctors. They would call them a medical director. They would give the doctor some sort of a role in this process. I think they got paid some modest amount to review medical charts after the fact. If I were a doctor, I would want to turn in my medical license. I'd worry about being prosecuted as they should.
Okay.
So you have Ms. Crawley with actual knowledge of the fraud, and our position, of course, is that any error associated with instructing the jury about deliberate ignorance under those circumstances would be harmless. And on the subject of the balancing instruction, there was never any proof that Crawley actually believed her actions were legitimate, which is precisely what the language of her own proposed instruction required. Without proof of what she actually believed, there's no factual basis for the requested instruction. If there are no further questions,
What kind of credentials did the Hulls have?
Well, I know that Jim Davis Hull is purported to be, he's represented as being a lawyer and a judge. Well, he's some sort of a municipal judge. And I do not know that Ms. Hall had any kind of credentials at all.
His wife was not any kind of a licensed therapist or anything?
I'm not aware of any credentials on that in that school.
I saw that reference to being a judge, municipal judge, you said, in Mississippi?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I believe Jackson County.
All right, Mr. Pettigrew, you have some rebuttal time.
May it please the court, in your questions to the government, I did some research. There was in the court record, there was motions to reconsider that I filed post-sentencing. That's a record, I believe, at page 326. That indicates that Crawley, about $131,000 of this was traceable to Crawley, according to my motion.
Could you say that again?
$131,000 was traceable to Ms. Crawley, according to my motion. And the motion was basically saying that the proof was inadequate, and the judge needed to reconsider the amount of restitution and the scheduling issues I've raised here on the appeal. And so, based upon the fact that there was a timely motion to reconsider, before we filed the appeal, that the court below had the opportunity to reconsider. And it later denied the motion after we filed our notice of appeal.
Well, the Hulls tried before the same district court?
Yes, Your Honor.
And they've been convicted?
Yes, Your Honor.
Have they appealed?
No, Your Honor. Jim Hull had a plea agreement which eliminated any appeal. And Pam Hull was Mrs. Crawley's co-defendant in the trial. And then she later pled guilty in the companion case.
All right. And what is their restitution obligations, or do you know?
I don't know what Jim Hall's is, but I believe Pam Hall's restitution is exactly the same amount as Jackie Crawley's.
You talking about $2,500 or the $32
million? I believe it's the $32
million. Okay. You can continue.
Anyway, the standard review then for these questions about restitution amounts would be an abuse of discretion standard as opposed to clear error type review. In regards to your questions about the check marks being consistent with the with Jackie Crawley's position about an arm constituting three parts of the body, the hand, the wrist, and the shoulder, there's no evidence that was not the case as far as the documents that were produced in that. There was evidence that the Jackie Crawley's talking about her procedures of putting check marks on the treatment sheets based upon locations of the bodies was corroborated by the technician's testimony.
Was there evidence that Medicare did allow billing at some stage based on an arm being three units of treatment? I mean, was that part of her evidence, that this is the way it once was, perhaps when she got into this?
Jackie Crawley's information as to how to bill on this physical medicine was based solely upon how she was trained at Statewide. And so.
But you don't recall any evidence being introduced that is the way at some stage to bill, that billing was authorized?
I recall now, there was a book that Jackie Crawley had attended to a seminar in September 2003, in which she saw that you can bill on the basis of body part, and it also indicated elsewhere in terms of time. She read it to mean that it confirmed to her that you can bill on the basis of body part. The question is, what was her subjective, did she have the criminal mind, and did she, based upon what was informed to her? The government makes much to do about the fact that the regulations at Medicare are available to everybody in the world, but not everybody in the world understands those regulations. And I think Jackie Crawley was one of those people, and so she shouldn't be held accountable for what the regulations would have said.
Mr. Pettigrew, the court acknowledges that you are court appointed, and we appreciate the job you've done to help us and your client in this appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here the next case.